Russian forces are making gains in eastern Ukraine. An American pastor who's been delivering aid to civilians there says people are worried.
That's the reason why I'm leaving, is because I don't foresee it getting better anytime soon.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Uganda, at a home for orphans, there have been complaints about alleged abuse for years.
I keep hearing complaints. But again, you also keep seeing people taking their children.
That's part of our investigation into children's homes in Uganda. We'll also hear about China's ambitious target for economic growth and about competition in another part of Asia over the Eras Tour.
Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, Hong Kong have got every right to be upset because they're missing out on the gravy here.
And because it's Taylor Swift, there's a lot of gravy. Those stories and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for joining us. Odessa, Ukraine was shaken by a large explosion today as President Volodymyr Zelensky and Greece's prime minister were touring the city. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said it's one thing to hear about the war and quite another to experience it firsthand. Odessa is in southwestern Ukraine on the Black Sea. At the other end of the country, Russian forces have been pushing westward after taking over the town of Avdiivka last month. Ukrainian-American pastor Alex Zaitsev knows the area well. Throughout the war, he's been delivering humanitarian aid to Avdiivka and helping members of his congregation get out. Many of them found safety 40 miles away in Pokrovsk in Donetsk region. That's where Zaitsev was when he spoke recently with The World's Marco Werman.
Alex, thanks again for being with us. What is the atmosphere like right now in Pokrovsk? How tense is it?
It's actually pretty tense. They've been launching rockets from planes or whatnot at our city and the surrounding cities right around 1 at night. So most people wait to hear, you know, the explosions and then go to bed. And actually in one of the cities where we have a church, it's close enough to be reached by artillery, and it's being destroyed right now.
Can you help us understand, Alex, how the battle lines are shifting right now in that part of Ukraine?
Avdiivka was taken, and then several other villages were taken. So now the front line is a straight line, and the Ukrainian army stepped back, and now they're trying to dig in the area where they are now. But from what I understand, it's going kind of rough. There's not enough equipment and manpower. Since New Year, it's gotten a lot worse, where now we're losing villages, apparently.
As we said, many of those people who were in Avdiivka are now 40 miles to the east. How are residents reacting to all of this? Are some starting to pack their suitcases and leave the area altogether?
Yeah, some are starting to pack because we've been having rockets at night hit schools and other places where soldiers live. The residents of this city who are loyal to Russia, they're selling out positions where soldiers are, and that's where hits could be made. So people are pretty worried, and many are either already evacuating or seriously thinking about it.
Can you repeat what you said a moment ago, Alex? Who is selling out Ukrainian positions?
People living here on Ukrainian territories, but people that are loyal to Russia, or people that want Russia to take this city. Or it could be just people who are making money by sending coordinates of where soldiers are living, either that be schools or daycare centers, or recently one of the big supermarkets that is closed right now. There was apparently soldiers living there, and there was a strike close to it.
What goes into the calculations of residents there when they consider whether to stay or go? Like, what concerns are they weighing?
Well, the big concern of why not to leave is because where will I live? Worries such as that. And also, like, the men are saying, oh, I won't be able to find a job there because I'll have to do it to the military office and I might get drafted.
Wow. What about Ukrainian soldiers? Are they visible in town or on the outskirts of town?
They're everywhere. About 80% of the people driving around are soldiers. Recently, because there's been quite a bit of an influx of Ukrainian soldiers, they're trying to move in anywhere they can. So empty houses or basements of multi-story buildings, basically anywhere that they can find to live. And many people are scared of that because they're saying, oh, they'll move in and then there'll be a rocket strike here.
Yeah, so are the soldiers advising the residents on whether to stay or go?
They're saying go, because they're saying it's very doubtful that it will get better. They're saying it's probably just going to get worse and worse.
What has that done to morale, both among soldiers and among the population?
The majority of people are still hesitant to leave because they're saying, well, it's not that dangerous yet. But the thing is, I've seen that in Avdiivka, where people are saying, oh, it's okay, it's not that bad, and then it gets worse. And they're saying, well, it's still not that bad, and then it gets worse, and still not that bad. And then they're sitting in a city, living in the basement and cooking on open fires outside and still saying, oh, it's not that bad. Same arguments.
You are a pastor. Pastors shepherd the flock. That is your work. But in Ukraine for the past year plus, you have literally been working like a pastor, physically trying to shepherd people from one place to another. What has that felt like?
It's been difficult trying to keep up with the people that have evacuated, trying to help the people who are evacuating, and then try to keep in contact with the people that stayed to try to remind them that whenever you're ready to leave, we'll help.
Yeah, you've got a lot of people to look after. Alex, how are you sleeping these days? I mean, is it even possible for you to get a good night's sleep?
For the last month, yeah, it's been tougher. Shelling has increased, and you know, you understand that it's getting closer and closer to your house. The market where that was hit, it's actually right across the street from my house. So I honestly don't know what has to change here for us to be able to start liberating our territories. Obviously, you know, we don't have enough weapons, but I understand that it's up to very few people to be able to help us with artillery shells and whatnot. But that's basically what everything is down to at this point. So that's the reason why I'm leaving, is because I don't foresee it getting better anytime soon.
Ukrainian-American pastor Alex Zaitsev is in Pokrovsk in the Donetsk region, where civilians are considering whether to stay or evacuate as Russian forces draw nearer. Alex, thank you so much for your time. Take good care and stay safe.
Thank you.
We have an update for you now on a story we reported recently from Spain about a venture called WorldCoin that aims to scan as many human eyeballs as possible. As the world's Jerry Haddon recently reported, more than 4 million people in 120 countries have signed up for iris scans so far. That includes this woman at a mall near Barcelona, where a long line of people waited their turn.
They just paid me the equivalent of 2 days' wages, she tells me, leaving the mall with her young daughter. For those of us who've come to Spain as immigrants, she says, we've got nothing to lose. We just need to get by.
But today, regulators in Spain hit pause. They banned WorldCoin for 3 months and demanded it stop using data that it's already gathered. The Spanish regulator said biometric data has special protections in the EU because the information is personal and sensitive. WorldCoin says the regulator is spreading inaccurate and misleading claims about its technology. WorldCoin is a project led by Sam Altman of OpenAI. It was paying roughly $80 to Spaniards in WorldCoin's cryptocurrency for iris scans. You can find Jerry's reporting on this story and all of our coverage at theworld.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. Taylor Swift's Eras Tour hits the stage in Singapore this week. Swifties in the region are psyched, obviously, but there's also some dismay. Swift signed an exclusivity deal with Singapore's government, agreeing not to play anywhere else in Southeast Asia. Singapore's Prime Minister, Lee Hsien Loong, spoke about it at a regional summit in Melbourne, Australia, yesterday.
A deal was reached, and so it has turned out to be a very successful arrangement. I don't see that as being unfriendly. Sometimes one country makes a deal, sometimes another country does.
The specifics of the deal haven't been disclosed, but the Thai prime minister alleges it was worth $3 million per show. To understand what's at stake here for Southeast Asia, we reached out to Wayne Geerling. He's an economics professor at the University of Texas in Austin. Wayne, what more do we know about this business arrangement between Singapore and Taylor Swift?
The main thing to understand here is that this is a barrier to entry in economic speak. So Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, Hong Kong have got every right to be upset because they're missing out on the gravy here. So Singapore's effectively got exclusive access to Taylor Swift's concerts. I think there's six being played in Singapore. I think the first one may have been played yesterday. 50,000 people per gig, that's 300,000 people attending her concerts. An economist at Maybank estimated that that could bring in $370 million to the Singapore economy. So Southeast Asian nations are going to be very upset. Singapore's going to be very isolated at the next ASEAN meeting, I suspect. They might be sitting in the naughty corner.
So you said $370 million might be brought into the economy of Singapore for six shows.
Yes.
And the government of Singapore obviously thought it was worth whatever they paid Swift here, right, to get her to play only in their country.
It's reported $3 million per gig. That's an $18 million outlay for a possible $370 million return. I like those numbers if I'm in Singapore at the moment. So even if, let's say, they're doubling the estimate and it's only half of that, $18 million for a return of $180 million is still an excellent, excellent number. So I think the main problem here is that it's almost unprecedented that cities and countries lobby to be part of a tour. When ERA's tour was announced, Canada, our northern neighbours, and Chile got upset and lobbied to be put on the gig, right? They were left off the original concert dates for ERA's. And now with Singapore, with this exclusive deal that she's only allowed to play there in Southeast Asia, it's strange because it should not be a zero-sum game. She should be able to tour Singapore but add additional dates. But the reason why they want the exclusive arrangement is that they know that people who would see her in Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, Hong Kong will go there instead.
Right.
So they're actually gaining at their expense. So it's a smart business move.
Yeah. So Singapore offered these subsidies. There are examples of American cities offering incentives for example, pro sports franchises to set up shop in their area. Is there a pop music precedent for this too, or is this a whole new thing?
Not that I'm aware of. The interest in the ERA's tour is unprecedented. I mean, five continents, 152 shows. I mean, it sounds almost blasé when you go through the numbers. She's rewriting the rules of everything, how to re-record music and make money. It's astonishing. The interest in this tour, she played in my home city, Melbourne, last week. 96,000 fans attended three nights in a row.
Wow.
That's the biggest attendance on ERA's tour. I'm sort of proud of that, given that Melbourne is my home city. It's astonishing what's happening here. I'm old enough now to remember music across three generations, and I've never, ever, ever encountered something like this. It's truly phenomenal.
And I understand, you know, the study of this is called Swiftonomics. Besides revenue to a city or a country from a tour, what else can you tell me about Swift's larger impact on the economy?
So, I mean, Swiftonomics is really the economics of Taylor Swift and her impact on the economy. And it was used to talk about the sugar hit to the economy, the sort of first post-COVID positive demand shock. But Swiftonomics goes beyond just the ERA's tour. She's the first billionaire who has music as the main source of income. So the catalogue, 400 million, concerts, 307 million, streaming, 120 million, homes, 110 million, royalties, 80 million. These figures come from Bloomberg, reported last October. Washington Post estimates that she might make $4.1 billion in personal earnings from the ERA's tour in general. It's insane what is sort of happening here. And let me be honest, I'm not a Swiftie. So I'm not speaking from a position of bias here. I can look at her career purely in awe and respect. She's strong, she's tough, she's innovative, she's creative, and she gets what she wants. And the other fascinating thing when I was working on this Swiftonomics paper with my co-authors, her popularity is, the Beatles would be the closest to it. Which generation doesn't like Taylor Swift? I was at a pub a few weeks ago and I met a guy. He's part of the 50s for Swifties, right? This is not just teenage kids or boomers or whatever, or Gen X. It's nuts.
That's economist Wayne Geerling at the University of Austin. As he said, he's not a Swiftie. His mohawk gives a nod to his musical tastes. He told us this song is his go-to jam. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Ramadan begins this weekend, and both Hamas and Israel have faced pressure to reach a negotiated deal for a ceasefire before the start of the Islamic Holy Month. So far, ongoing talks in Cairo have failed to produce a deal. Inside Gaza, the situation is desperate. Experts at the United Nations on Tuesday called on Israel to end its campaign of starvation and targeting of civilians in the territory. A different team of UN officials this week found that there's convincing convincing evidence that Israelis were subjected to sexual violence during the Hamas attack of October 7th. Their report went on to speculate that there are reasonable grounds to believe that remaining hostages are still facing sexual abuse in captivity. Rebecca Rossman reports from Tel Aviv, and a note for listeners that her story includes details about sexual violence.
When Hamas militants attacked the site of the Nova Music Festival in the early hours of October 7th, 23-year-old Romy Gonen ducked for cover by hiding in a car with friends. But at 10:12 a.m., she was shot in the hand.
And she called me at 10:14, so I know she was shot.
This is Romy's mother, Mayrov.
Romy?
After several minutes of trying to comfort her daughter over the phone to the background noise of gunshots, Romy was kidnapped and taken into Gaza. Today, she's one of the estimated 19 women still being held hostage. But details about the hostages' captivity is scarce. Her mother, Mayrov, says she does know some things. She tells me Romy isn't getting proper medicine for her asthma or treatment for her chronic sinusitis and is constantly being watched by male guards. But Mayrov doesn't like to think about the details.
This is exactly the thoughts that I rather put out of my head. But I suggest to Google a little bit and see what the people that came from captivity was saying about what is going on with the girls inside the Hamas hands. They are the same one that raped women and then murdered them. The same men that butchered babies. Same men.
A report released by the United Nations this week confirmed that there was, quote, clear and convincing evidence that at least some hostages have been subjected to sexual violence, including rape, torture, and degrading treatment.
We have to prepare for the worst case scenario.
Dr. Haggai Levine heads the medical team for the Hostages and Missing Families Forum, the main body representing families of the hostages. For months now, his team of psychologists, nurses, and physicians has been preparing for a variety of worst-case scenarios. He says one big concern is that some of the remaining female hostages still in captivity are pregnant. Once released, he says they will all receive pregnancy tests and, if necessary, abortions.
Woman wants, there shouldn't be a problem for abortion, even at the late stage of pregnancy, that's in Israel.
Even if abortion is legally permitted in Israel, Levine acknowledges it's a very sensitive issue, which is why he also worries about ensuring the hostages' right to privacy. These people have become recognizable faces in Israel and all over the world, he says, without their consent, which means medical staff will need to take extra precautions.
You know, even the files, maybe to write by handwriting and not on computer, because someone who is supposedly authorized, you know, may enter the files and deliver the information. People are so interested, and we have to be very careful not to harm their privacy.
Then there are the steps that will need to be taken to rebuild trust.
This is a newborn baby. I mean, the people who have been through October 7th are new people.
Dr. Ofrit Shapira Berman is a psychoanalyst who specializes in treating complex trauma. She has been treating some of the freed hostages and witnesses of the October 7th attacks. She says it can take years for victims of abuse to discuss the details of what happened to them.
I also want to say to women who've been sexually abused, you have the right to not talk with anyone besides your family or your friends or your therapist about it, because it's still sexual. And no one really wants to talk about this intimate details with other people. So why do we ask women to do that?
When she thinks about her daughter, Romy, coming home, Mayrov Gonen says the first thing she'll do is hug her.
And we will cry a lot. I will pet her head because that's what she likes. And I think we will not talk.
Mostly it will be crying, hugging, and smiling, she says. The rest will come later. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Tel Aviv.
You might have heard the term Anthropocene. That's the proposed name for a new geological epoch marked by human activity. Scientists have spent years collecting evidence documenting that this period is already underway and deserves to be its own official epoch. Colin Waters, chair of the Anthropocene Working Group, spoke about that process with The World last year.
Some of the sites that we've been looking at, you can see the annual sedimentation of layers, layer on layer. Bit like looking at tree rings. You can actually count these back through time.
Scientists gathered sediment samples showing layers of evidence of human activity, things like nuclear weapons testing, the burning of fossil fuels, and pollution. Yesterday, the New York Times reported that a scientific panel of roughly two dozen members rejected the proposal for naming a new epoch. The headline read, "Are we in the Anthropocene, the human age?" Nope, scientists say. Here's where the science world drama starts. Not everyone on that panel apparently is in agreement. A press release from its chair said the vote on the issue didn't follow the rules, and they're looking to annul it. Francine McCarthy is one of the scientists behind the proposal for establishing a new epoch. She didn't hear about the panel's vote until she read about it in the news.
The nope response, you know, it was the title of the New York Times piece, is rather unsatisfying to a group of scientists who've spent a decade and a half on a task that they were given, to not be given any feedback beyond nope.
Like I said, science world drama. McCarthy and her team analyzed layers of sediment from the bottom of Crawford Lake in Ontario.
We outlined the evidence for a massive change in the Earth system in the mid-20th century. We identified at annual resolution fallout from nuclear weapons testing. So we were able to provide a very specific moment in time where this shift could at least nominally be identified.
The moment they narrowed in on, November 1st, 1952. That's when the first thermonuclear bomb was detonated in the Marshall Islands. McCarthy says she's confident that her team's research supports the claim that a new epoch on Earth began that day, but it might be some time before we know if it gets an official name. McCarthy says what's important is that people are now listening as the experts learn more about the impact of human activity on the planet. You're listening to The World. The Chinese government has big plans for growing the economy in the year ahead, but there are also some big obstacles. One expert calls them the four Ds.
Including debt, demographic, demand, and decoupling or de-risking.
That's actually five Ds, but you get the picture. We'll hear all about it ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. All this week, we've been bringing you a special investigation into Western-sponsored children's homes in Uganda. Here in the U.S., these types of institutions, often called orphanages, were mostly phased out around 50 years ago. Research showed that they were having negative effects on children. But Americans continue to provide financial support for orphanages in other parts of the globe, including Uganda. In our story today, The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakande takes us to a children's home run by Dutch missionaries that receives funding from donors in the United States.
I'm driving on a bumpy road through the Mukono district in central Uganda. I pass by busy towns and small farms before arriving at the gates of Noah's Ark Children's Ministry, Uganda. It's a non-denominational Christian children's home run by a Dutch missionary couple. Inside Noah's Ark is a sprawling compound that has grown to include a health clinic and schools. On Sundays, they hold a prayer service where children of all ages perform songs and dances, sometimes to foreign visitors. Pete Botendyke founded Noah's Ark with his wife, Pita Botendyke, in 1999. Back then, Uganda was dealing with an ongoing armed conflict in the north, an HIV/AIDS crisis, and enduring poverty. This all left many vulnerable children in need of care.
Welcome by Noah's Ark Children's Ministry Uganda, Raisa and Pete and Pita.
The organization shares details about their tragic lives online, like children being found in pit latrines or in plastic bags. Their slogan has been that they're turning these vulnerable children from nobody to somebody. But behind the smiles and cute babies, the world's year-long investigation has uncovered years' worth of allegations against Botendyke and his organization, which has been described as a place of fear, according to interviews with more than 15 former staff, volunteers, and people who grew up at the organization as children. I meet one of the young people who spent most of his childhood at Noah's Ark. He asked to remain anonymous because he fears repercussions for speaking out. His story is being read out by a voice actor. He tells me that in the early days of the organization, all of their basic needs were cared for.
Most of the times we had a lot. We had enough. Too much, in fact.
At times, the organization overflowed with donations, sent from abroad in huge shipping containers. Still, this young person and others say the children feared Botendyke.
Most of us, we felt that it was like a normal thing. But if you're used to it, you know.
I asked this young man if he ever experienced abuse.
Did that ever happen to you where he hit you?
Yeah, it has happened to me. When I was still 13, 14, in my stubborn years.
He says Botendyke also used harsh punishments to discipline them, like forcing them to stand outside at night in the cold.
Like for an hour or two. But it depends what you did. Sometimes we will be stubborn. Also, the aunties used to do that. I think they copied it from him. They're not allowed to hit the kids, so they just, like, put them on the wall. So the aunties also used to take advantage of that and make us stand on the wall for hours and hours, even outside in the dark.
Beyond these alleged abuses, there have also been questions about the quality of care given to the children. A former staffer tells me she worked at Noah's Ark for several years. She also asked to remain anonymous because she says she fears the repercussions of speaking out. Her story is read by a voice actor, too. She says she also witnessed Botendyke being abusive to children. She was particularly concerned, though, about the food being served.
They bring when it's already expired. He wants cheap things. And even if children say, I don't care, eat.
For years, similar complaints and allegations remained between former staff and volunteers. But that changed in August 2018, when two things happened. First, the government office overseeing children's homes received an email that included letters from former foreign volunteers dating back to 2013, with allegations of child abuse at the home. Here is one, read out by a voice actor.
As soon as Pete or Peter enters the children's home, workers and children are nervous and scared. Pete and Peter are always yelling and shouting to workers and kids.
The letters described specific incidents of alleged abuse by Botendyke.
She had to put her arm on the dressing table and he started beating her until even the baseball stick broke into two pieces.
And another.
I went to Pete and Peter to ask for advice what I could do with this boy to help him with his problem. Pete said I will teach him to stop it and beat the boy with a stick.
The letters also allege Botendyke beat staff and treated them like slaves. Days after receiving these complaints, government officials and a police officer conducted a fact-finding mission on the ground. Then, about a week later, they received a second whistleblower complaint against Noah's Ark, this time from Uganda's toll-free National Child Abuse Helpline. John Mugisha is the government official who coordinates it.
They were saying that the children are fed on expired food. These were all allegations that were being fronted. And then some of the children are physically abused.
I visit the office of government official Shafiq Butanda to talk about these years' worth of complaints against Noah's Ark and to find out what actions have been taken. Butanda runs the unit overseeing children's homes.
I keep hearing complaints. But again, you also keep seeing people taking their children. Because every year, people complain.
Butanda suggests these complaints could be a result of fighting between staff and former staff with the heads of Noah's Ark.
I'm not saying that Noah's Ark is clean because you have not done maybe a thorough investigation to find out. We have not also found out why people keep insisting that there is a problem. But at least what I'm aware of We have so far made about 2 or 3 visits between 2018 to 2023 about complaints. So I don't know whether former workers are witch hunting the director. I don't know. But it keeps coming.
And if complaints keep coming, why hasn't there been an investigation?
I want to say that for the 3 times you have been there, we have gone there to investigate. But we find them clean.
Clean isn't the full story, though. An internal government inspection report from 2018 that was never made public found that children were being fed expired food. The report included pictures showing milk that was 4 months past the expiration date, as well as expired baby food. It said that there was poor management of the home, citing how staff were not sure about the number of kids that were there. The highest estimate being 200, which was 6 times more children than they were legally allowed to have. It also said that they did not have the mandatory court documents to care for some of these kids. Mugisha from the Child Abuse Helpline tells me Noah's Ark was told to resettle some of the kids at the organization back with their families.
They gave the director, at least I remember, a specific period to work on the issue of the number of children who are excess to be resettled. There are those who are ready for resettlement that have not been taken.
Noah's Ark was also told to build the capacity of its staff and address the problems about the expired food. It's unclear to what degree those issues were addressed or whether these issues continue today. As for the most serious allegations that were brought to the attention of the ministry, there were clear limitations to their field visit. For one, the report doesn't mention talking with children living there. It also says that the team of government officials and the police were not able to speak with any of the 4 social workers at Noah's Ark because they were not around. At least one former staff at the time alleges they were ordered to disappear in advance after being tipped off about the inspection. But Butanda, the government official overseeing children's homes, says staff are part of the problem too. He argues a culture of silence and unemployment in Uganda keeps staff in these children's homes quiet.
He comes from a poor background. If he sees something wrong, do you expect this person to come out and say there is something wrong? He will now weigh, if I say this, how am I going to benefit? So he'll keep quiet and wait for the time when they will maybe sack him or her. And come out and say, I've been keeping quiet for long.
He advises staff to report while they are still within an organization. But in this case, based on my interviews with more than 20 people, staff and volunteers have been complaining about Noah's Ark Children's Ministry for years, including to police and different government offices. I reached out to Noah's Ark founder, Pete Botendike, about these allegations of abuse over the phone.
Is there any response you have towards these allegations?
A beautiful story. Wow. Well, I don't have any complaint or any comments on that because it's just rubbish, but it's okay. I'm used to all sorts of stories. So that's life in Africa.
In a follow-up email, Noah's Ark said that they deny all of the allegations, that no child has been harassed or beaten, that all their staff are treated well and respectfully, that they are not aware of the allegations about shouting at staff, that the institution is managed and run professionally, and that there are no complaints with any regulator. I read the young person who grew up at Noah's Ark some of those old letters from volunteers that were sent to government officials in 2018. I ask him about the one where Botendike allegedly hit a child with a baseball bat.
I remember that day. I don't know. I think she did something bad. And I remember they'd beat her with that baseball bat and it broke in two.
I read through the other alleged incidents of threats, intimidation, physical violence. His eyes get wide, and he shakes his head in disbelief at the level of detail.
For this, does it seem like they're speaking, like they're exaggerating? Or?
No, it's facts. They're speaking the truth. I was old enough to understand.
I ask him what his message would be for volunteers or staff who had told me about the issues they saw at Noah's Ark.
They should have, like, brought it up to the authorities. Like to the people in charge or to the organizations out there who are responsible for sending the donations and stuff. Or they should have sent, like, spies or something to come and inspect and see. But if it's 10 years ago and nothing has been done.
As much as this story is about children, the more I spoke with the adult volunteers and staff who had worked at Noah's Ark, it becomes clear to me that part of the problem was also how they felt vulnerable and exploited. Many people I've interviewed told me they feared Boat and Dyke, who they saw as a well-connected, rich and powerful foreigner in a country where poverty remains a big issue. I visit a popular hotel restaurant in Mukono to meet with Francis Oliput. He tells me he used to work at Noah's Ark. He says Boat and Dyke would intimidate the Ugandan staff.
Yelling at people is common, and it is true. He does it. I think maybe it is his management tool, but he yells at people. Yeah, he yells. He can even bang your table if he comes to your office. He speaks at the top of his voice.
Many of the former staff I interviewed told me they feared losing their jobs if they spoke up about problems they saw.
Then there's also fear of arrests, where any small mistake, you know, you'll be taken to police.
Several people I interviewed also told me that they saw or experienced Boat and Dyke hitting or shouting at Ugandan staff. But for all of these issues, Oluput says he still sees the need for this type of organization.
We have so many children who are still being thrown due to our economic situation. There is a lot of unemployment. So many people are jobless. We have a lot of families breaking down. And these ladies or men fail to take care of the children. And these children end up being thrown. And police has to pick them.
One person I spoke with has a different view. Samuel Businde Salongo is a vocational education specialist who says he also used to work for Noah's Ark. He says the organization had some good ideas, but ultimately has done more harm than good because of these alleged issues.
He's again adding salt in your wound. He's not solving a problem.
He argues Noah's Ark is exploiting children because of their circumstances by soliciting funds, using their stories of neglect and abandonment, and sometimes even including photos of naked, abused children online.
I'm very concerned about it, and that's the eyebrow-raising issue. If someone has got a tragedy of that nature, why casting him or her on the internet? If you are sure you're going to help, take him privately. Then you stay with him until you are going to release him or her.
He argues poor parents wouldn't abandon their children if they had the means to take care of them in the first place. He worries about what happened to the kids who grew up there.
Who knows what happens to them after this? No one. So, yes, you've taken me to your home. You are going to help me because you found me. I'm homeless. But after 10 years, where am I going?
He implores donors to ask these questions. The young man who grew up at Noah's Ark Children's Ministry tells me when he left the organization, he wasn't given much support or details about his family or the circumstances that brought him there. In his view, Noah's Ark raised him to be dependent on them. He tells me growing up, they were rarely allowed to leave the compound.
We all struggled with the same thing. Like, we had to face the real world. Like, no one was telling us how things operate in the real world.
While being out of the children's home has been a huge adjustment, he also calls it a blessing. The motto of Noah's Ark Children's Ministry is that they help children go from being nobody to somebody. But this young person disagrees.
When I got out, that statement, I didn't resign to it because it doesn't make sense. Everyone was brought here with a purpose. We can't just be a nobody. I don't know. Maybe the point they're trying to say is maybe like helping somebody become somebody. That could sound much better. But calling us nobodies, that doesn't make any sense.
According to Uganda's laws, children's homes are not meant to be permanent places for vulnerable children. They're meant to be a last resort. From the moment a child arrives at an institution, they are required to find a more permanent, family-based option for the child, like reuniting them with direct or extended families, fostering, or adoption. I ask this young person, if these had been options, would he have preferred it?
I think that would be better. Like, because then they're you can see the money being used in a way because it's given to them directly. And then, okay, you can have corrupt parents, but still, if the parent is willing enough to give you to an organization because he can't take care of you, it's better you give him the money and then, you know, he can do it by himself.
He says he hopes one day to be able to get more details about his family and maybe reconnect. For the World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Mukono, Uganda.
Tomorrow, we bring you the final installment of Halima's investigative series about children's homes in Uganda. For this one, she introduces us to an organization that's become a model for actively trying to move kids away from institutional care and bring them to families. Coming up, macroeconomics in China and an auction house item in the UK. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Beijing has set a 5% target for economic growth in 2024. China's Premier Li Qiang made the announcement. 5% is the same growth target made by the Chinese Communist Party last year. It lined up with analysts' expectations, but the year ahead for China is expected to be tougher. As the world's second-largest economy, China has a supersized influence on global fiscal health. Zoe Liu is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. She spoke with the world's Marco Werman.
What was your first thought, Zoe, when Li Qiang announced that 5% target for growth? A modest goal or an ambitious one given the predictions for the year ahead?
The growth target is not surprising at all because, you know, it's very much in line with analyst expectation. And also it showed the Communist Party of China's realization of the necessity of maintaining the growth momentum while at the same time needs to boost the confidence in the economy.
So what are the main drags on China's economy as you look at the year ahead?
The framework that I use to characterize the drags on China's economic growth dynamism is the so-called 4 Ds, including debt, demographic, demand, and decoupling or de-risking. In the near term, especially for the year 2024, addressing the debt issue, especially at the local government level and the property sector, as well as domestic demand, in particular household demand and household consumption, are the two priorities.
So can you talk a little bit more about the demographics part of that?
It's in popular news these days that China is facing a demographic time bomb, specifically due to the slower or negative population growth since 2022. For a long period of time, China has implemented the so-called one-child policy. As a result, the lack of labor support or supplementary, given that retirees are dropping out of the labor force. And on top of that, it's also creating a lot of cost for the social security system.
So tied into all that is this fact that Chinese factories produce way more than Chinese consumers will buy, and that population is slowing down. Some of that is understandable, of course, since there's a lot of export from China. But how is that reflected in the modest growth goal of 5%?
In the growth target, I think right now, at least from a Premier Li Qiang's Chinese government work report, it put supporting consumption ahead of supporting government investment. But fundamentally, I think the Chinese economic system is not built to boost the consumption because the system is very much built to drive government-led investment as well as export.
Right. So there is this global impact given China's economic muscle. Prices on Chinese exports have been going down. So how is that going to play out in foreign markets, especially the U.S.?
In an ideal world, right, when the price of Chinese export when it goes down, it should be good news for American consumers because, you know, whenever you buy things on Amazon or you go to Costco or Walmart, the price of your purchase should go down. But now we are not in an ideal world. And, you know, the escalation of U.S.-China trade war have not necessarily benefited U.S. consumers. And on top of that, although cheaper import is good for American consumers, it's bad news for American manufacturers.
So I saw in the reporting on this announcement of the 5% growth target that Li Qiang actually had a draft version of the announcement in which, quote, intensifying geopolitical conflicts were cited as being one of the negative pressures on China's economy. But apparently Lee skipped that sentence in the speech. What do you read into that?
That's an interesting take. There are two ways to interpret that. One is perhaps they just forget. Then the other part is the acknowledgement of the Chinese economy needs to be more focused on strengthening domestic capacity and more specifically self-sufficiency. Then it could be isolated from international tensions. But in the current globalized production system, that's ultimately not possible.
China is known for playing the long game. Is China's economic planning limited to the next year alone, or are there clues as to what China will be doing in the years ahead?
Marco, you are right. You know, the Chinese economic planning is about planning the long game. And the 5% target is actually targeted to achieve the 2035 goal, meaning by 2035, the party needs to achieve so-called socialist modernization. So it is about the long game rather than just focusing on the immediate term.
Zoe Liu is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, speaking there with Marco Werman about how China's goal for economic growth squares with some of the economic challenges faced by Beijing. Pride and Prejudice fans, we've got some fun news for you. Do you remember that much-celebrated scene from the British TV series with Mr. Darcy emerging from a swim in a wet button-down shirt? This is the moment of inception for the love interest that drives the whole story.
Miss Bennet. I
did not expect to see you, sir. We understood all the family were from home, or we should never have presumed.
I returned a day early. Excuse me, your parents are in good health.
Yes, they are very well. Thank you, sir.
I'm glad to hear it.
The scene featuring actor Colin Firth in an old-fashioned button-down shirt stole the hearts of many since it first aired in 1995. Well, a British auction house just sold that iconic shirt. It went for $25,000. The proceeds will go to a charity that supports arts education. Over the years, this soggy garment became synonymous with Colin Firth. It sort of helped launch his career. In an interview on UK television, Firth said he was originally supposed to do that scene in the nude because men simply would not have worn clothes to go swimming during that era, but TV standards prevented that.
No, so I just thought, all right, spontaneity. If you can't just strip off, then dive in fully clothed.
Other movie props have been sold off at the same auction house where the shirt was sold. A hooded cloak Meryl Streep wore in The French Lieutenant's Woman went for $9,000. A red Christian Dior ball gown Madonna wore in Evita fetched a cool $50,000. Colin Firth's shirt might not have gone for quite as much, but it still lays claim to being featured in one of the most memorable scenes in British broadcasting. Thank you for being with us today. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. We're online all the time at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you right back here tomorrow.